So, good morning. Today's the third full day of retreat, and probably you've been experiencing lots of things, but usually by the third full day of retreat, you're starting to have some difficult experiences as well as nice ones. And so this morning I thought I'd say a little bit about the teaching on the hindrances to meditation. So I'm not going to say much because normally this is a guided meditation session. So I'll leave some room for some guidance as well. Does anyone have any idea what I mean when I say hindrance to meditation? Yes, a few nods. So it's basically that in coming to meditation, we're inviting the mind to be present, and we would like it to be peaceful. And very often it's not. Very often we either come to some state of disturbance that is already there, or the very act of inviting the mind to be present actually kicks up some resistance. So the Buddha had some understanding of this, and so there's a teaching on these five classical ways in which the mind tends to get disturbed, and there's a really nice image. So so imagine your mind is like a clear bowl of water. So when it's settled, they didn't used to have mirrors in India. It was like a time when they didn't have mirrors. And so to see themselves, people would look in a bowl of water, like one that's not been disturbed, and you can see your reflection quite clearly. And that's what we're hoping to do in meditation, is to see into ourselves quite deeply and quite clearly. And what happens is we look and the water is very often pretty disturbed. So we get all sorts of distortions and feeling like, oh my God, do I look like that? You know, is that me? Is that who I am? And if we didn't have a bigger perspective, we would believe this is who I am. This funny looking distorted thing that I'm seeing. And so in meditation, actually, it can be sometimes a really painful experience when we go inside and we feel like, that it feels so tight, or it feels so restless, or I have so much desire, or so much aversion, or I just can't settle at all. I'm like just doubting all the time. Am I doing the right thing? Is somebody else doing it better than me? Like, these are really, really painful experiences. So it's just to acknowledge that and to recognize that you're not alone. Like, all of us have these things. Every single one of us in this room is going to have some kind of disturbance going on. Even sometimes they can be very deceptive. So Noon has spoken the other day about attitude in meditation, and that attitude of striving. That's when our wish to come to a peaceful place in ourselves becomes so strong that we actually suppress everything. So that's actually desire and aversion acting in the mind during the meditation. So it's like we have to actually be really attentive and really careful and really be willing to dig and see and look clearly into what's going on. So I'll just list the five hindrances, and it's quite helpful. They're kind of in pairs. So there's one. So imagine you're inviting your mind to be present. And so one possibility of what happens is immediately your mind gets caught in sense desire. So what I was saying the other day about opening to the senses and making it possible for a sound to come in and a sound to go out again without grasping onto it, that's one possibility with the senses. Another possibility is that an impression comes in and you go, oh, I want that. I want more of that. And so that's something that's possibly coming up in your meditation. So maybe you're thinking about lunch all the time, and then this is really unworthy, so then you're averse as well. You know, it's like they kind of kick each other off. So sense desire is a particular experience that you can notice as arising in your meditation, and you're not alone in that. It's just really good to know that and to have the courage to meet and investigate what is going on. Is this balanced? Is there a pulling towards something? So feel that pulling in your body, but you don't have to go after it. That's the thing in meditation. You can meet the experience that's arising and know this is what's happening. And then you're not anymore that thing. You're not caught in it. Does that make sense? Not sure. Yes? So, the opposite pole from sense desire is aversion. And this would be not wanting whatever experience is arising in you. So say you have some pain or some desire or a wish for your meditation to be otherwise, a wish for your meditation to be more peaceful. That's also aversion. It's aversion to what is actually present. So again, it can be a case of just catching that and going, oh, this is what's going on. This is aversion. So you don't have to believe it. So I have a good friend who she was a really, really diligent practitioner, like really, like many, many hours a day, and like just really kind of applying herself to very focused meditation. And she said, like, she'd been meditating, say, since 5 a.m. with a short break for lunch. And then at 5 o'clock in the evening, so 12 hours later, she got up. She was like, okay, I think I can have a cup of tea, you know, whatever. And apparently her mind was like, you see, you're such a bad meditator. You can't keep sitting, you know. And she said it was like catching the delusion with its hands in the till. She was like, aha, you know. She saw at that moment, this is what my mind is. This is aversion in my mind. I've been meditating for 12 hours. It's like, but actually, those tendencies in our mind, it's like they'll never be fulfilled. Like when aversion is active, like that self-aversion, also grasping actually in that case. So it's like both sides of the coin. It's like, it's never enough. As soon as you believe them, they'll just feed you another line until you keep going. You keep going until you know you can convince yourself after 12 hours of meditation it's still not good enough. So it's like, so this is, it's actually, so it's a bit of a challenge to turn around and to be able to discern in ourselves, is this for my well-being? Is this voice for my well-being? Or is it actually a delusional voice that is pushing me and pushing me and pushing me? So the other side, so sense desire and aversion are two of the hindrances. Another set of the hindrances are sleepiness or sloth. I don't know if you know this word. It's sloth and torpor. Do you know what that means? It's like when your energy's really like, oh no, I can't be bothered. You know, it's like, oh well, all right, I'll go and sit and meditate, but then I'll just like, I'll kind of hang out. It's kind of okay. Like, and an hour later you get up, you know? So that's sloth and torpor. And restlessness is, most of you probably, I don't know, I get a lot of restlessness, so I kind of assume everybody knows what it is, but maybe not. Restlessness is a lot of agitation in the body or in the mind. So always looking to be somewhere else, to be somewhere else, to be somewhere else. So again, it's to know, oh, these are human experiences. And they're also a resistance to being in the present moment. So very often if the mind doesn't want to be present, it'll go, oh, I just go to sleep. It's like, it's much nicer. It's kind of pleasant, except if you're sitting in meditation like that for hours, it's not so pleasant. Actually, it's pretty unpleasant. But the mind thinks it's going to just soften the edges a little bit. And we can also... So Noon and I have been emphasizing a lot an attitude of gentleness and of listening, which I think is really important to counter the attitude of striving. But it's not laziness. Like, laziness is an unwillingness or a resistance to bring your energy up to meet what is going on. So, and that's not, again, it's not a judgment. It's just to know this is happening. Is this for my well-being? And if it's present and you feel it's not helping you, then pay attention to it and do something which counters that energy. So if you're feeling very sleepy and you're not actually, there's no reason really for you to be physically tired, it's likely there's a form of resistance to being present going on, and you need to sit up or stand up, open your eyes, pay attention to the in-breath, something that will bring energy into that state so that you're actually giving yourself in the best way you can to an activity you're choosing to do, which is trying to become present in meditation. So the first stage is actually becoming present to whatever state is going on. And if that's sleepiness, bit of, not to judge that, but to balance it. So bring energy. In these ways, physical ways of like opening the eyes, sitting up, even standing up, as long as you're not going to fall over on the person next to you because you suddenly have an attack of sleepiness. It's like, these are really helpful ways of countering that. And restlessness is the opposite. It's a state of like just continual agitation, or even like feeling very, very energized, like, you know, kind of buzzing. And that can, when it goes into the mind, turn into a very active mind that is thinking a lot or that is worrying. So worry is another possibility with this kind of energy, where you're just constantly, it's like a dog chewing a bone. Like, it'll keep going, but if I just, like, give it a bit more attention, it will release, you know? And it's seeing, like, in if you're working with the mind, at what point is my going towards something and giving it attention helpful? At what point is it helping it to release? And at what point is it just repetitive? You know, this is a habit. This is a need to have something going on in the mind. That's restlessness. So again, it's like noticing what's happening, meeting it, and opening your awareness around it. So it's not the whole thing going on, that it has more space. So I find with restlessness that because it's so intense and focused, it can be really good to find a different space around it. So if you're having repetitive thoughts, just notice those thoughts are happening in a larger space. They're not the whole of what your mind is. Try and bring your mind back down into your body. And if there's restlessness in the body, bring it to something very grounded. So like the weight of the body on the cushion, the stability of that, and let the energy kind of ground, like as you would an electric current, really. So I sometimes wonder with restlessness, because I had childhood epilepsy, and they did lots of tests on me, so like lots of electrodes on the brain and blah, blah blah, very complex tests apparently, and their conclusion was she has too much electricity going to her brain. And my mum was like, what, you know, after all those tests, you know, so, and they said as my body grew, I would grow out of it, which I did, but I still have quite a lot of electricity going around in my system. And
renewable energy in yourself.
Quite, yeah. Just put a light bulb on me. But anyway, so that's a bit of an analogy, but it's actually physically true. So it's like actually restlessness is it can be a very physical phenomenon as well. So. So I find it really helpful really to come to the stability of the earth, the stability of the bones, the settledness, and the pleasure in that. You know, there's a certain well-being and pleasure that comes with feeling stability, and let the restlessness touch into that and go, ah, that's all right, you're here too. So it doesn't, you don't feed into it by getting more agitated around it. So, those are some different, ways of working with restlessness. Come. I'm going to do number 5. She thinks I've forgotten about number 5. You're doubting me. So, number 5, doubt. So yeah, doubt as the state where just you're always second guessing your experience. So you settle in and you're listening to a guidance, or you've moved towards an object in your own meditation. You're starting to settle there, and suddenly a voice will come in that's going, "Oh no, maybe not, maybe." Maybe this time I need to be using another technique for this, or like where your mind won't allow itself to settle on an object. So all of these hindrances are various ways in which the mind will not allow itself to settle. It will try and hijack your attention. But it's so doubt is particularly hard to deal with because it can be very slippery. So like restlessness often has a very physical manifestation. So in that way you get some clues, but doubt can be just like a really, really underlying sense of this isn't quite good enough, I should be doing something different, I should be somewhere else, is meditation worth it at all, what am I doing, you know, like that kind of thing. So and so it can keep us moving and moving and moving in a very insidious way. And like with the other hindrances, I find one of the best ways of dealing with it is to actually turn around and just meet it. So these things are trying to hijack your attention and to take your attention elsewhere. And so one of the best ways of meeting them is to go, okay, well, I give you my attention, but I do that consciously. So I'm conscious of what you're doing in my body and my mind. So if I'm experiencing doubt, what does that feel like in my body? Is it like a closing in and a withdrawing and a like, is it quite okay? And in my mind, what does it do? Does it cause a kind of, what does it do? It's going to be different in each of us. It's going to be like in one person it will create a kind of erratic rhythm of hopping about, and in another person it will tend to be more like a, I just don't know, you know, kind of. So like we're turning the attention and giving it quite fully and investigating whatever it is that is trying to take your mind elsewhere. And then you've kind of stumped it. You've kind of gone, okay, well, a bit like my friend who she was like, well, I've caught the delusion with the hands in the till. It's like, I just meet you as you are. So, and to bring investigation and inquiry to doubt counters that very energy of like, I can't, what am I doing? I can't possibly, you know, whatever, meet this or meditate or whatever. You're bringing then the very tools of meditation to that experience. So it's very powerful. And then I have to say that with doubt, I think it does have an aspect which can be useful. So, so one of my teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, he had a lot of doubt at the beginning of his practice, and he actually meditated on it, to the point where it broke apart his rigid worldview. So he'd been thinking meditation should be like this, the monastery should be like this. This is the direction I want to go into in practice. And the doubt kept blocking him until he was like, this is how it is. So the doubt blocked him and blocked him and blocked him. And then he was like, well, actually, I don't know what my experience is supposed to be like. I don't know what spiritual experience is supposed to be like. And he opened to that unknowing. And in that, because in one way, doubt can be very corrosive if it stops us from deepening. And in another way, if our mind is too rigid, that can also stop us from deepening. So sometimes to have room to question, so this is like turning doubt into inquiry, that can be quite a powerful tool as well. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Yeah, so there's five of them. So I always see them as two pairs and then doubt in the middle, yeah? So there's doubt in the middle, and then there's sense desire and aversion or ill will. So they're one pair. And the other pair is like sloth and torpor, sleepiness, that quality, and restlessness. So they're like energetic opposites, if you like. And then doubt in the middle.
I would just like to comment on doubt. I had a friend once that used to come with me to meditation evenings. And then in one evening he heard the teaching about doubt as a hindrance. And he's really a critical thinker, very analytic and very critical towards any kind of like power systems or in communities if there's something unhealthy going on. He's very critical and very avid to find all the unhealthy things that are going on and so on. And then when he heard that doubt is a hindrance and doubt is sort of not allowed, he never came again. Because he didn't want to be involved in a spiritual activity where doubt is
exactly
critical thinking.
Right. Hindrance. Yes.
So would you like to comment on this? Because there might be a mixing going on.
Yeah, there can be a really big mixing going on. So I really like in Jungian psychology, the archetypes, and the I mean, I don't know that much about it, but there's the image of Coyote, who is the one who questions. So like often in myths and cartoons, even like Wile E. Coyote, he's like running around and he questions a lot. And that energy, when it has its place, is really wholesome. So I read a lovely quote, which it was somebody quoting somebody else, but it was like, have an open mind, but not so open your brain falls out. You know, it's like, you know, so it's like we want to keep discernment. So discernment is actually a spiritual quality. And I think discernment linked with your intention of practice in practice, which is of, I mean, we're going to formulate it differently, but freeing the heart from greed, hatred and delusion, say, you know, so discernment of what is active in the mind or active externally is really important. So, and I would say that that's the same quality of questioning which can become unwholesome in doubt. So, but that same quality of questioning can be wholesome in learning to discern, is this for my well-being, the well-being of others, the well-being of both, Or is it some form of greed, hatred, or delusion that is active? So, and where that becomes unwholesome in critical thinking, which is where coyote in that archetypal scheme is when you're taken over by it, you will never let anything be or recognize that this is not a perfect realm. It's rare that you're going to find a perfect situation with a perfect setup. Things will be good, not good, somewhere on the spectrum, and it may change. So it's like there's also some value in having a capacity to go, well, this situation's good enough. Actually, this is good enough for my practice. I don't need to change this, this and that. And and actually one of the things which I found very important in the ethos of what we're doing at Ekutu Laini is that we meditate outside a lot of the time. Conditions are not, you know, perfect for perfect stillness of mind if you want everything to be controlled. It's just not like that, you know. But I find there's a liberation in being able to go, I can be at ease, I'm present with what is in this situation which has a lot of supportive conditions, where it's not perfect, but it's good enough, you know. And I think there's a big learning in finding out where one's questioning is actually a discernment of this is harmful in some way, like a real way, for myself or for others, and where it's just my mind wanting to pick holes in things all of the time and to stay in, my mind thinks it can be in control and it wants to control things all the time, and in the end that's an incredible suffering. So this is in part why we put ourselves in a kind of container like this in a retreat, where we're going to meet some of our edges, where we don't like everything. Why is the timetable like that? And why is the food like that? And why is she talking so much? And, you know, it's like we get to meet that edge and we're asked to stay with it, to not leave the room. So, yeah. Does that answer? Yeah. Do you guys want to add anything?
What I like a lot in the Ajahn Chah tradition is the way Ajahn Chah used to speak of the hindrances. It's like that word, hindrance or obstacle. It sounds like something we need to get rid of. And he used to say, that's just what they're called, but they're actually friendly tools. They're friends. You know, and from just sitting, observing, you know, wanting, not wanting, agitation and sleepiness and doubt, you can get enlightened. So they're actually tools. They're like the, you know, the pathway to freedom. So not to be seen as something that I shouldn't have, and it should, okay, it's coming up. Oh, so definitely I can't meditate. Not to be got rid of. But rather, here comes one of those tools again. Here comes, you know, wanting, not wanting. I can get curious about that and get to know my heart mind. That I found very, very helpful. To not build up a thing of, I'm getting it wrong.
Yeah.
But, here are those tools again. And those things come up, those five come up in retreats, wherever you are, in all cultures, normally on day 3 or 4. That's what's funny. So that helps, that really helps to know that it happens to everyone, even to the teachers. Hey, you get hindrance day the same, or 2 or 3.
Actually, exactly what I wanted to say, that is a really important learning there, something can be really useful to have an experiential sense of that and become familiar.
I was wondering there, were you translating the word discernment? what is it in Finnish?
I think because there can be quite confusion, because I said it's critical thinking in Finnish, like thinking and ajattelu, and then you were using critical thinking and, you know, doubting. But we can also say, I think, kyseenalaista, but it's a kind of, Is there any other option for that?
Would it be like erottel, like separating one thing from another, like looking clearly, this is this and this is this?
Yeah, erottel, good, good, good. But it's about, you know, really kind of inquiring into things, so it is in a way critical thinking when we say in Finnish, but not the kind of criticizing mind.
Yeah, so just to add, like, I'm totally with you guys on that. You know, these are, like, so much part of our experience, and they're so much of our path, actually, to freeing up, and the capacity to get to know them is really, really important. And that's why we've been teaching so much about coming into the body, about some tools to help bring some kind of basic stability where you can feel well in meditation, so that if you, because there's a difference between being courting something and being able to know it. And in order to be able to know it, you need sometimes a little bit of space. You know, you need to be able to stay awake in the experience somehow. And so, like, to have some other reference points to be able to come away and just like, okay, well, I can stay here in this, like the contact with the earth, or in order to come back and meet what's going on. Sometimes that's very helpful, because to be actually caught in the current of it, you know, it's like wherever you kind of wake up and know, oh, this is what's happening, that's great. But if you've been dragged 100 miles down the road and suffered for 3 hours with it, you know, sometimes you can catch it a little bit sooner if you have got some reference points of stability in the meditation, which is why we've been doing so much about coming into the body, coming into a sense of well-being, not to push those other experiences away, but that you've got some other flavour going on in your experience, because it's like you don't want to be totally overwhelmed by what can be quite a painful and difficult experience. You need some other points to come back to and go, oh, okay, rest a bit. Okay, now I can come and meet you again. So Ajahn Chah said, he said that it's like being the host in a house where guests come in. So, like, you meet them, you're like really welcoming, and you know, hello, can I give you a cup of tea, and what would you like? But you don't kind of move out of your house so that they can have it, kind of thing. There needs to be a kind of presence with what's happening. So, yeah, which I'll say a bit more about later, but yeah.
To not be flooded, hey?
To not be flooded. So, yeah, go on. So there's also a beautiful phrase in the text that says, you know, so this experience arises, but it did not invade my mind and remain. So it arises, it's welcomed, but it doesn't invade and take over. So now we've just got a very short time left for meditation. So I think I might just be quiet. We'll just sit quietly for some minutes, and we'll find another time to do a meditation on the hindrances.